the blood money will be given to the husband, 1 million.
Okay.
Look, now, is it something positive for men or women? Of course, it's for women, but sometimes people deliberately misinterpret it.
Okay.
Because it says that it is given to the woman, says that you can spend it for yourself. You have no any responsibility to give it to the children, to your relatives, to your, for example, children, so and so. But when half of that, when 1 million is given to the man, he has the responsibility to take care of his father, mother, children, wife, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So here we see that it is something positive that is given to the woman.
And at the same time, the husband is obliged to give nafaka, alimony, and also this mahr, you know,
to the household,
the marriage gift.
Exactly.
Yes.
Same is the case here. When girls reach the age of puberty before men, before boys, it is a kind of blessing. It's a kind of ni'mah. It's a kind of superiority for the girls over the boys. Because what does it mean? It means that the age of bulugh, maturity, and puberty for ladies are sooner and earlier than the boys. It means that they very soon reach to the level that they can talk to Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that they can perform rituals, that they can be good mu'min, true mu'min. It means that their mentality, their aql, their intellect improves quickly as compared to the boys.
Yes.
So that's why naturally it is something positive. But when it comes to those, let's say, hardships, sometimes challenges or difficulties that a girl might suffer from, and fasting, for example, when she is 9 years old, there are, you know, different signs for puberty.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the age.
Okay.
Okay? So that's why if the other signs are not there, the ladies, according to some of the maraja nowadays, they say that even sometimes, for example, a girl might fast, for example, when she is 13 years old, because in that age, the other signs of puberty will be seen in the body of that girl.
So age is not
is one of the signs,
criteria for
it's one of the signs, yes.
Bulugh or baligh or the age of.
And also, if you see, mostly the girls really, really reach the age of puberty sooner than boys.
Mm-hmm.
If they are brought up in a very normal kind of situation, it seems that like the hormones or things that are in the bodies of women are more active.
Yes.
And they grow up very quickly, very fast.
That's right.
And that's why when you see that nowadays, for example, in universities, we have more than 60% of the students of universities are girls.
Yes.
Only 40, so less than 40% of the students in universities are boys.
Yes.
Because of what? Because these ladies and boys and women are more, are rich to that age of, let's say, intellectuality or, let's say, kamal and perfection before the boys.
That's right.
That's why the number of them is always more than the boys.
That's right. Okay. So some people also ask that, isn't the age of puberty related to the era in which we live? For example, the Arab girls on that time at the early Islam, for example, were stronger, or the situation or circumstances in which they lived made them more powerful than the girls today, also the boys. What's your answer to that?
You know, nowadays, of course, we do not have an exact statistics in the whole world that nowadays how is the situation and conditions for ladies, for women. But normally, for example, in Europe, in America, in Africa, in Arab world, even in Asia, mostly the girls reach the age of puberty before the boys.
Okay.
It is something that nowadays you see that, for example.
So what are the signs, Sheikh? Can you enumerate some of the signs?
There are some.
The hormone difference is one of them.
Yeah, hormone differences
finding,
are there.
Finding, for example, menstruation, blood money, the money or period is one of them. Okay, so what about the other
And signs? Also, the other point is that, you know, the women cannot give birth to the kids or to the babies after 40 years old. You know, when they become 40 years old, this stops.
Okay.
So that's why from the beginning they become young very sooner, you know, quickly, because men are always capable to have children, for example, after that age as well. It seems that everything in nature is balanced, you know. There are some hikmahs, there are some wisdom behind this, that what are some of the benefits of this for ladies?
Yes.
And what are some advantages of this and advantage of this kind of puberty, age of puberty will go to the women themselves?
Yes.
IRIB English Radio presents questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Religiously speaking, what are the responsibilities of the baligh people, those who reach the age of puberty? And is it so that they must start their religious obligations right after the age of puberty? Or no, before that, there are some recommendations to do so.
You know, age of puberty is like a da'wah, like an invitation. You know, when we were so young, sometimes, for example, our parents or elder brothers were invited to some, for example, invitations as guests, you know?
Yes.
We were really sad that why we are not invited in that, for example, wedding ceremony or, I don't know, with that party, for example, invitations,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
Because we did not deserve at that time to be invited.
Yes.
But once we become, for example, older, for example, like 15, 18, 20, then we will be invited like the other people. So that's a kind of pleasure.
Yes.
Here, for example, the holy month of Ramadan, ibadah, prayer, talking to Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a kind of invitation.
Yes.
Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala send his invitation to the girls sooner, earlier than boys. So that's why it's a pleasure for ladies.
Okay.
That Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tell them that you can come, you can become my, let's say, guest. I send the invitation to you when you are only 9 years old or 10 years old, you know? So that's why it is a pleasure for ladies, it is a pleasure for women, that they deserve to receive the invitation of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in that age, but boys later in 15 years old. So when you are like children, well, when you are so young, like teenagers, like kids, for example, even if you invited somewhere, no one expect you to observe certain, for example, rulings, things in that gathering and that, let's say, place that you are invited. But once you become like the real guest,
yes.
Of course, in that case, you will be expected to observe certain things when you are taking part into that, for example, gathering, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
To sit in a special way, to talk in a special way, you know, to behave, to respect the others, to treat the others very respectfully with honor, and others should respect you, others should honor you, you know? So yes. These are the things that you have to be obey and follow. Same is the case with these responsibilities for ladies and men and women when they are invited in the let's say invitation of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
Then they should honor themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They should observe let's say certain things for themselves.
Yes.
They should behave differently. They should treat others differently. They should respect themselves and others.
Take care of the mahram,
non-mahram.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a kind of pleasure, you know,
uh-huh.
It's when, for example, a king invites you in his own castle.
Uh-huh.
Of course, he expects you to treat, to behave respectfully with honor, you know. Not only yourself, the king, the people, all the participants in that gathering. Here, as the parable of this invitation is like that you are invited now in the very, very, let's say, highest, what you can say, in the very, qualified kind of invitation, then now you have to observe certain things because mm-hmm. you are honored with this invitation. That's why we should look at all these observations respectfully, what we can say honorably, because it is like a pleasure, like an honor that we are now invited in such a place and we are expected to observe certain things. We should treat like with honor, with respect, with
yes.
dignity, you know, with chastity.
Yes.
This is for not only for the ladies, also for boys.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of bulugh, or age of puberty according to religious beliefs. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, please visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fi al-jannati nahran min labani aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. لعليٍ وحسينٍ وحسن إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن لعليٍ وحسينٍ وحسن لعليٍ وحسينٍ وحسن كل من كان محباً لهم كل من كان محباً لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن إن في نهراً من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will monitor the Doha negotiations' move to conclude a captives exchange deal while they're opposing ideas in the regime regarding this issue. We will also go over Netanyahu's criticism of the West's position after the German Chancellor's visit to Tel Aviv and the refusal of the tribes in Gaza to the United Nations' request to distribute aid. We'll also touch upon the internal Zionist disputes. Regarding these topics, I welcome Professor Hadi Kobayesi, Director of the Al-Ittihad Research and Development Center. My warm welcome, dear professor. The United States is more enthusiastic about the truce and the captives exchange deal because it will also withdraw on the Yemeni front, which is what Biden needs in the heat of the presidential elections he is running. Professor Hadi Kobayesi, what do you think of the articles of the negotiations in Doha, Qatar, and what the Hebrew media mentioned about the American goals of this truce and the exchange deal? That is, calm on the Gaza and Yemen fronts, as Biden needs it in the upcoming presidential elections.
We prefer to deal with American and Israeli statements with great caution, based on the experience of the past 5 months. It is clear that there is great manipulation in the distribution of roles, and there are varying and contradictory statements from official spokesmen and media professionals. I mean, a few days ago, there was talk about the Security Council session. The American presented a paper for an immediate and permanent ceasefire. The session took place a few days ago. What happened to the discussion? The discussion was limited only to Yemen and the condemnation of what Yemen is doing. Yesterday, there was a call between Biden and Netanyahu. Netanyahu said that in the call, I talked about the continuation of the war, entering Rafah, achieving goals, and eliminating Hamas. There was no American statement explaining what happened in this call. Yes, we have a distribution of roles between two parties, and we must be careful in evaluating each movement. We are approaching the elections in the U.S., and therefore the Americans need an image, calm, but at the same time, the American image must have two components, an Israeli victory and an image of some peace, normalization, humanitarian aid, and truce. Biden cannot have the absence of unity in these two forms because he needs AIPAC. He needs the support of the Israeli lobby, and he needs the votes of Muslims. And he's trying to get this needle out of this haystack. He is trying to support the Israelis to an extent and at the same time humanitarian aids. If we noticed this last month, for example, under the roof of this slogan, under the policy that the U.S. follows, with all the aid that intervened, Israel committed massacres, about 50 massacres, and the Americans didn't talk about it. Biden did not comment. He did not comment. I mean, he sends aid by air or by sea while there are daily massacres, but he does not have a permit, and therefore there is such a coordination between him and the Israelis. It means he sends aid, but the Israelis prevent them. Biden would say, "I did what I had to do for my American voters, but I did not do anything that would embarrass the Israelis in front of the Jewish voters or in front of the Israeli lobby."
Let us turn to Smotrich, who strongly opposes any captives exchange deal with Hamas and sees this as a threat to the captives. The attack on Rafah will be scheduled after knowing the outcome of the negotiations in Doha, and as soon as the occupation army begins transporting the displaced Palestinians from there, the enemy will begin the opposite of this attack. Professor Hadi Kobayesi, Israel links the attack on Rafah to the fate of the Doha negotiations and Smotrich's position of basically refusing to negotiate with Hamas.
Smotrich and Ben-Gavir do not have a change in position or a political process in thinking. One position from the first road to the last road, regardless of the results, the effects, the repercussions of relations with the Americans, and the situation on the ground.
Even Ben-Gavir called for the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh instead of going to the Doha negotiations.
The movement is disconnected from political reality. It has goals that it sets, and by following them, it comes to the results and the possibility of achieving the goals, their outcomes, and their repercussions. What about Rafah? But this movement is being used by Netanyahu to say that I have a movement that I don't know what I want to do with it. And I have to sponsor it in front of the Americans, in front of the liberals, Gantz and others, and also in front of the Palestinian negotiator, because they use this scarecrow. As for Rafah, we will see the negotiations, and I believe that according to the scenario I mentioned at the beginning, the war is continuing. And when Biden spoke, when he attacked Netanyahu with the same speech, he said two things: we will not stop the weapons, and we will not stop the war. We will not stop supplying weapons to Israel, and we will not accept stopping the war. These are frank words from him. I think this scenario is the one that works.
Let us move on to the visit of the German Chancellor to Tel Aviv, which was less sympathetic to the regime than his first visits, as he affirmed his rejection of military action in Rafah, which would lead to the starvation of the people of Gaza. After the visit of the German Chancellor and his stances, Netanyahu began to harshly criticize Western leaders because of their positions that are against starving the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
Netanyahu's statements were the subject of interaction on Israeli social media sites, and these are some of the comments.
Nedav Monk.
That is, they all say that security is stable.
Uri.
Netanyahu has been removed from our lives. You have destroyed everything. There is no security in the streets.
Ina.
The people here are also pushing for elections. The polls speak for themselves.
Dana.
Is there anything that Netanyahu did not succeed in destroying? Now also the relations with the United States? Enough has exhausted us. Leave.
Ilana.
You continue the war and do not return the kidnapped people in order to remain in power.
Fernanda.
They all want you to leave. Enough. You have destroyed Israel. You have brought the greatest disaster on it. Leave.
So, Professor Hadi Kobayesi, how do you explain this sharp criticism by Netanyahu of Western leaders after the positions of the German Chancellor, which were less sympathetic to the regime than his first visit, as the Hebrew media noted?
In the West, it works on several layers and several levels. One of the levels of work and courses of action is to prepare and invest in the results of the war. It comes as a savior, as an assistant, as a mediator, as a manager of a peace process and a negotiation process, and to avoid all the negative effects of the war that have been a repercussion. Demonstrations in the West, security crises, expected future crises, political differences even within parties. The West, for example, France and Germany, is one of these players who was initially supportive and sent arms to Israel. They all arm Israel from behind the curtains. But on the surface, they say, we hear the people of Gaza starving, we're helping them. So that the Palestinians took to the West as a party that has credibility and legitimacy and has pure, good, positive, and humanitarian intentions, and therefore preferable to Gaza. This is according to Western thought. They say that the Palestinians sees that we come to Gaza, carry out a peace process, carry out a security movement, communicate with the tribes, communicate with the notables, and carry out political and field intervention within the Gaza Strip, so that we can achieve the goals of the war that Israel started, which is to change and modify the social and political situation inside the Gaza Strip. This path is progressing, even if the war will not end, but they have begun to prepare the image, language, discourse, positioning, and behavior to play this role inside Palestine.
In short, why does Netanyahu criticize them in this way?
It was a response to the American talk of the elections. The Americans have a collection of interests. It has a personal conflict, meaning there are personal interests between Netanyahu and Biden. Biden wants to go to the second term of presidency, and Netanyahu wants to remain in power. The problem is personal. Under the general policies of the two countries, the course of the war was underway and the whole world was happy. The basis is that we achieve the goals, eliminate the extremists, go to peace, and establish normalization. The Americans emerge as a peacemaker and thus left the Jews and Muslims and their reconciliation among themselves, and he wins at home. What happened is the delay in achieving the goals, and it has become a problem. Achieving the goals has not yet happened, and the time is running out because the American elections are getting close, and thus the Americans are taking action. They want to hold Israel, which has failed to achieve the goals, including Netanyahu. Netanyahu is the one who bears responsibility for the lack of electoral votes for Biden, and Biden holds him responsible.
Let us remain with the United States, as it's in a desperate situation. No one gives it any weight, not in the regime, not even in Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. One of the most important achievements of Commander Yahya Sinwar is that he succeeded in creating a rift between the Israeli regime and the United States. Professor Hadi Kubayesi, what do you think of the words of this Zionist analyst who describes leader Sinwar as a wonder who succeeded in creating a rift between the regime and the U.S., which seemed to be in a situation where no one gave it any weight, according to Af Aitiam, the former Zionist minister?
Of course, there is a little bit of exaggeration in his words, or a provocation for the Americans who changed the way they deal with the Israelis. He even goes beyond the electoral issue and deals with it as an issue for the regime. I mean, if it was an issue related to the regime of Israel only, I believe that they would not have any problem. If Biden only takes into account the American strategic political considerations and its interests in the region, he will clearly go with them in the war. But as a result of the elections issue, they're demanding the U.S. go beyond the elections and treat them as a state. One of Netanyahu's main advisors is the one who incited him to carry out the ground operation and continue the war. And his words are clear. He portrays the Americans, as well as Abramovich, as people who are against Israel and are putting pressure on Israel and are silent about it, while the other parties are waging a war against Yemen. They're waging a war as well, and they have carried out strikes in Iraq and Syria and are arming the Israelis day and night. But they, the Israelis, are saying, you are our enemies. You're fighting us in time. We must be friends. This is Jewish talk. Jewish grievance is their adopted method, exaggerating grievances in an illogical and unrealistic way.
I mean, Professor Kubayesi, Mohammed Dahlan's plan is clear as if it is an Israeli-American plan par excellence. What is the purpose of publishing such plans at this time in the Hebrew media? And basically, do you think they are correct?
It may be realistic, but it is a dreamy initiative. I mean, if the war goals raised by Netanyahu were achieved in the event of eliminating Hamas, there would be a possibility. But we should refer to the analyses, and not only the analyses. What does the annual threats report of the American Intelligence Council say? It says that in the coming years, the Israeli forces will try and struggle to dismantle Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And Hamas has proved that it will rebuild its strength and pose a threat to the Israelis outside the Gaza Strip during the next 5 or 6 years. We're completely far from this proposal, meaning the reality on the ground. I cite the American statement or the official American analysis, which is an official document of the state, to say that they also acknowledge and admit to the media that they want to deal with this reality. But the reality on the ground indicates, and the events inside the Gaza Strip show, that this issue is very unrealistic.
Professor Hadi Kubaisi, what is your explanation for this insistence by the United Nations and the West on giving a role to the tribes in the issue of aid distribution without coordination with the Hamas movement?
They are establishing the political alternative. The land, society, and social infrastructure become separated from Hamas, and therefore Hamas has no role. Little by little, this land is demanding the authority of the technocrats, and we will reach it little by little, gradually. This is part of the course of the years that they are talking about, and in fact, Gantz talked about it at the beginning of the war or the first month. He said, we need 10 years. This is a path that requires cultural, social, and security adjustment, and an adjustment in the balance of power at the level of the social structure.
The tribes rejected this proposal.
Here, his explanation for the tribes' refusal is that they are afraid that Hamas will not be eliminated, and thus Hamas will rebound and react to it. But the reality is that these tribes are Hamas, and there is no difference between them.
Director of the Al Ittihad Research and Development Center, Hadi Kubaisi, thank you very much, and thank you all for your good follow-up. Greetings until we meet again. God bless you.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Our greetings and salams and respect and salutations, first of all, to the Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi, Ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu sharif, and to you, dear brothers and sisters, who are listening to another episode of the program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to delve a little bit deeper into challenges and problems that you, dear parents, Muslim parents, might have with regards to raising your lovely dear teenagers. And alhamdulillah, in the studio we have our dear guest, an expert of the program, Sayyid Salman Naghawi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University. His specialty is Islamic studies. Assalamu alaikum, welcome.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much.
So previously we were talking about problematic teenage behavior that I think comes from a problematic household where nothing is at its own place and you've waited too long, or like you had spousal problems, or you have just had a divorce, or it's you're not even in a divorce, but there is like, you know, the parents are not talking to one another, and the child was faced with a situation where in practice he or she didn't feel secure and loved, and so that anger is accumulated in that child, and so in the teenagehood it bursts out, right? And he or she has a lot of power physically, and he will talk back to you, he will stop listening to you. So we did mention a lot of points where how you can, you know, restart, have a fresh start, and things that you can do. Any other points that we should take into consideration?
Yes, basically we were talking about the person who has to enforce the rules. So in my opinion, it was the father who is the person who is going to establish those rules.
It's so good to have the father establish.
Yes, that is important. But you, then the wife has to play, as I said, a role, a supportive role. And she has to reinforce that, and the children should know that they are their parents are unified in their in whatever they're doing, even behind their backs, behind each other's backs. You have to stand with whatever has been decided by mutually. You need to discuss. I mean, before you can establish those rules, when you can enforce those rules, you need to work them over together first. Discuss them amongst yourselves that we need to, you know, establish those rules. I will mention them. Or even the father can ask the mother to mention them and, you know, announce them. Sometimes mothers are more assertive in their behavior. Sometimes fathers...
Is it good, though?
I mean...
Usually in those families where the mother is too assertive and the father is the nice guy, he's the nice cop, the mom is the bad cop. Mm-hmm. But you usually are... You're supposed to get love and affection from the female side and like assertiveness, authority from the male side.
That should be the case. But unfortunately, sometimes even in those relationships which between the spouses also... That's the problem. Yes, it goes back to that situation where if the wife is supposed to be assertive, then she's mostly because she wants to have a dominating role even over her husband. And that gives a lot of, you know, stress for the husband because the men want to be respected and women
want to be seen.
Yes.
And recognized as the authority of the house.
Exactly. And wives want love and affection.
Right.
So if...
and respect, of course.
If it's the other way around, then, you know, the person who is sometimes in the situation where the wife is assertive, then she does not leave any room for the respect of the father. Mm-hmm. And that diminishes the role of the father. And then he seems to be, you know, kept out of the, you know, loop. So the husband or the father then takes a back seat, and that is not a good situation. That's not what as I have always been saying, that the family unit is the basic unit of society, and when the whole society has to fall under the umbrella of the wali, then the smallest unit of the society also has to have one wali, one right. guardian. So the mother has to reinforce that position, and she can't show to her children
that I am the wali myself.
I'm the wali myself, and I don't care what your father says.
Thank you so much. Let's go for a short break, and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters in faith. I hope that we are answering one of your questions and concerns that you might have with regards to your teenager. Sayyid mentioned that as the community, as the Islamic community or the Islamic Ummah has a wali or a person in charge, a leader, the house, the family, which is the smallest cell or unit in a society, should also have a wali or a guide or a leader. Oftentimes, some women, because of what they have been experiencing in their own life with regards to the role that they have learned from their own parents, they feel that they're very bossy, they're very assertive, and they don't give the man the arena to become the assert, you know, to assert the rules. But there's also the case that the guy, the man, the father is not well aware. He's not a manager. Like she would love to give him the authority, you know, the position to guide the family, but he's too concerned about other things, or he's not a well-informed and educated person who should take the right step at the right time. So she gets she's like, so what should I do with this guy? He's not doing his role. So she takes precedence and she takes his role.
Of course, this is then goes back to the fact that basically a child upbringing starts from your spouse selection, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's much before the birth of a child.
And even much before marriage.
Yes, much more before marriage, of course. So you need to, as I have been saying, that competence and being a person who carries out good deeds, a salih person, is a competent person. He or she needs to be able to basically manage her or his relationships. Management of relationships is the key. Is the key, because management entails planning, doing, checking, applying, adjusting. You plan something, do it, carry it out, check, and then you adjust yourself. And it's the same as we used to say, wise sages used to say, musharata, muraqaba, muhasaba, mu'ataba. I've mentioned that before in some of the programs, that management is general management and specialized management. Whether it is general management of human relations, every human being has to be a good manager. He or she has to be able to carry out musharata, is planning.
With regards to his own conduct and behavior.
Exactly. His conduct with respect to whom? Mm-hmm. There are four relationships, as we have stressed and emphasized, with ourselves, with other
God,
human beings.
God, environment, and the family.
Yes. So we need to, with Allah Almighty, managing our relationships requires musharata, planning, deciding to take the proper decision, the proper steps, the appropriate steps based on our worldview, based on our ideology. We then carry them out with muraqabah, with the remembrance of Allah Almighty, that Allah Almighty is watching over us. Then we carry out muhasabah, account, make accounts of what we have done. And then we need to do ma'atabah, to correct our course if we are deviating. So this management has to be learned by human beings at a very, very early age.
Which a lot of us actually don't do.
And so managing, leading, leadership qualities, managing, education, all of this is something we have been mentioning, that education is a sort of leadership.
Right.
And therefore, we need to learn these things. And then we come to, before we get married, we have these things in our minds, which we don't usually have them. Especially when we are living in Eastern societies, marriages are arranged. Of course, I'm not saying that arranged marriages are bad marriages. You need, whether it's arranged or it's someone whom you choose, but the basic thing is that we need to make the right choice in an intelligent way. We need to understand each other. We need to be able to, see whether we are compatible with each other.
Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back, you brothers and sisters. We're talking about the root of problems or rudeness or negative behavior that we witness from the side of our teenagers. And we finally got its root in the behavior of the parent themselves, where our expert, Sayyid Naqawi, mentioned that much before marriage actually takes place, a person has to learn to manage his or her behavior through planning, carrying out that plan, checking it, and adjusting himself or herself, which unfortunately most of us although Islam is so rich and beautiful in instructing a gorgeous life for all of us, we seem to, you know, delve so much deeper into the material realm, and we get educated with regards to physics and chemistry and our future career, and we unfortunately neglect to pay attention to our self-development, which is the essence of a righteous family. Okay, what next?
So we need to, as we said, model, give them a model for from ourselves, and to assert that model and to show them this is, but this has to be done with love, as we have been saying. We should show them assertive behavior, but they should also know that it is because our parents love us. If they are setting these boundaries, if they are asserting them and demanding from us, it's purely because of the fact that they love us. The way we conduct ourselves, the way we enforce those rules is important, because we need to show them that it is for their sake, for their benefit, and it's pure love and compassion for them. And they should understand that it is for them that we need to model them, we need to mentor them, we need to show them that this is something which is for their benefit. And we need to, you know, give them all the time. We can't give up on them. We can't say, though, they're
it's
a failure.
Too late. I can't do anything. No. It's a failed case.
It's a failure. No, we have to try and try again. We need to give them a chance. Every failure leads to success. We need to back them up. You need to give them confidence. We need to support them and remind them all the time. And it's not easy to do. We can't expect results in a day or so. It takes time. We have to be patient.
Months or sometimes years.
Yes.
Thank you so much. This takes us to the end of another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing. Thank you very much for listening to us. And wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim,
I am a Muslim.
Islamati,
Allah my Lord,
His word Quran,
Muhammad Prophet,
praise be upon
him. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Youth Station. Well, once more, I am honored to be here. And this is Asma. Well, I'm not alone. I have a co-host in here, Brother Mustafa.
Assalamu alaikum. So happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's always happy to be in Youth Station.
We've been talking about different things related to Ramadan. And of course, we know that Ramadan is a very spiritual month. It has a lot of spiritual benefits for us. However, apart from the spiritual benefits, you know, there's a lot of talk about sort of the non-spiritual benefits of Ramadan, right? I can definitely think of many, many different benefits.
Non-spiritual benefits.
Yeah, non-spiritual benefits. You know, things that impact other... Although, you know, one way, it depends on how you define spirituality as well, right? One could say that all of life is spirituality, but sometimes we can sort of like separate the two, right? What would you say are some benefits that you could see in your own life or in others that you've seen that would maybe fall into that category?
The one that is interesting, like I used to say, that there are some of those people who, when they enter the holy month of Ramadan, it's more of a party. Like for these party comers, the thing that's going to happen in their life is that they're going to take care of what they eat in a more of a, you know, as if they are going to have more of a healthy diet, like in these days, because they have to watch over whatever they eat. So this is one point.
There's definitely a lot of health benefits. There's so much discussion about, you know, the number of health benefits that fasting has during Ramadan. You know, just losing weight, I think. But, you know, we do have like a lot of recommendations about what we should be eating, how we should be breaking our fast. I think if people follow those sort of, the Prophet and the Imams, they gave us diet plans as well.
Yeah.
You know, what are some of the best things? And now we have doctors who do the same thing as well. They tell us, you know, what you should eat, when you should eat it. I think if you follow those sort of guidelines, then you won't face that issue. Whereas you'll face that issue throughout the year as well, in a way, right?
Exactly.
If you're not having a good diet. But, I think I mentioned another episode, you know, I taught intermittent fasting, right?
Yeah,
which is very popular, you know, in terms of losing weight. You know, the people use that. Intermittent fasting would be basically you're fasting on some days and you're not fasting others, or you're fasting certain hours of the day and you're not fasting others.
Yeah, special hours.
So those have like benefits on your diet. Yeah. So I think that's like just one of the big benefits that I can see.
Exactly. For the people who are seeking to know what are the non-spiritual benefits that I would get from the holy month of Ramadan, the other one, I guess, is going to be for those people who go to work. They have to learn how to manage their time.
Managing your time, on top of that, I would say managing like yourself and your like, you know, stress.
Exactly.
Without food and water and like, you know, maybe sleep. That is it trains you to manage stress better, right? I feel that is a benefit. Although I know in the beginning of Ramadan, like my wife will tell me that I'm being really grumpy, for example, you know. For us who, you know, for anyone who's trying to be better, I would say then you'd learn to handle stress and like difficult conditions way better than
that's a nice point as well. And then when the holy month is finished, I guess for those people who go to work regularly, like they're going to be so proud of themselves for what they have achieved, because the number of hours they're going to have asleep is going to be reduced. The number of time they're going to be devoting for their job is going to be reduced at home, I mean.
Right.
Like if you have a research like me, you're not going to have enough of time to go for it. So things are going to be so problematic, yet you have to learn how to manage it.
Well, you know, I think that's another benefit, by the way, that it breaks you from your normal routine.
Mm-hmm.
If you're maybe spending, let's say, too much time on your studies or too much time on research, and those are things that you should be doing. I think Ramadan gives you the opportunity to sort of break away from that and devote your time elsewhere. It's kind of giving you a break, right, from your day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
So I see that almost as a positive as well.
I hope teachers would understand that.
that
would be so good if they understand this angle of life as well.
Right. Another part I think related to this is like breaking your habits, right? I think we all have certain habits that we would like to let go of, we would like to change, right? And Ramadan has that benefit in the sense that not only is your routine changing, but your willpower is becoming much stronger.
Oh,
right?
Now that you're speaking of willpower, let's go for a break.
Okay.
And then we'd be back.
Okay. Okay, so we're back from the break, and
and it's Youth Station, by the way.
And this is Youth Station. We're back from the break, and you know, I was discussing right before the break that one of the sort of
willpower,
the one of the non-spiritual benefits, maybe. Although I think this
for the party comers,
I think by the way, this is directly related to spirituality, but we can sometimes people will categorize it as sort of non-spiritual, right? In the sense that because your willpower is used in many places, right? when you're forcing yourself to not eat, you know, when you're preventing yourself from not eating, obviously your willpower is becoming stronger. And so in Islam, you know, we talk about the jihad al-nafs, you know, our struggle with ourselves, right, which is considered to be the greatest struggle, even more than like a normal war, for example. We all know the popular hadith, you know, in the Prophet went to war.
To overcome the internal conflict.
So one way to do that, by the way, is we're recommending in Islam is to even prevent yourself from having halal things, right?
Yeah.
So, of course, eating and drinking is a very halal act, right? You know, we're supposed to eat it to survive. But during Ramadan, we're told not to do it, right? We're told not to do this halal act. It becomes forbidden for us. That's one way we're making ourselves stronger.
A practice of that conflict and war, the internal war that we go through.
And that helps breaks habits. Mm-hmm. Like I know many people who smoke, right? And they can't smoke during this time. Some people end up coming out of it and they quit their smoking habit as well because of Ramadan. Not everyone.
They have a strong will, I suppose, because some other people, unfortunately, it's very difficult to change your habits.
It is.
Only by going through 30 days, unless you are concentrating on that. You are focused on that desire to change something in your habits.
You're right. I mean, that may not be the only method, you know. Yeah. Sometimes it requires more. Sometimes it may require medicine if you want to quit certain habits. But what we're saying is that it helps, right? It has a benefit.
Another
even
point,
on a small level.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, go ahead.
So another point I would say is to wake up at midnight and have some praying time for yourself. That is also another interesting part. Actually, it's spiritual.
How would you say that's not spiritual?
See, for example, like for when my grandfather was living with us, when he was with us, he could not actually fast. But the thing that happened for him was that he woke up with us for the midnight. Mm. And then this was a change of mood for him. Like, he was sick and he could not fast. So, spiritually, he was not connected to the ritual that we were going through. But at the same time, he was going through some good emotions and feelings, like he's waking up in the midnight and he's having some, you know, chit-chat with his children. So, it's going to be a change of a mood.
You're right. And I see that with my kids, by the way. You know, my kids are 10. My son is now 10 and my daughter 7. So my son, for the past at least 3 to 4 years, I remember he would love waking up for the morning, you know, for the sahri, the morning meal before fasting. And yeah, he loved like we were sitting in the dark. You know, he wouldn't let us turn on the lights, for example. We would have a small light on. He enjoyed that aspect of it a lot.
Now, even we have been through that. I remember even in my childhood.
Yeah, yeah, same.
It was just an amazing thing to wake up with them. And the night which they did not wake me up, I was just angry with them in the morning. Why didn't you wake me up?
Oh, man, you sound just like my son. Yeah.
Yeah. So, because it's an interesting emotion, like it's a different thing.
Well, related to this is sort of, I would say, the social aspect or impact of Ramadan, right? That just the fact when we sit down together and we have this sort of different meal, either with if it's just with our family or even if it's with, you know, friends, that's a huge benefit, I think.
Of course.
Just getting to see people, getting to talk to people.
You get to know more about them.
Yeah, yeah. And then I would say a big non-spiritual benefit is the food, right? The amazing dishes that our moms or other family members make.
They're going to be too creative in this month.
Right. So those are amazing benefits that I think we can see that come out of this.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Well, one other factor I think that sort of comes to my mind is concentration.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if this is a benefit, by the way. I think this is maybe a non-benefit.
To concentrate more for people who are overthinker, it's not a good thing to learn.
Although, you know, one interesting thing is that, okay, so one thing that happens for me during Ramadan is I end up sleeping less, right? Even if I want to sleep more, I can't. I think a lot of times people have the opposite effect, they end up sleeping more.
Yeah.
For me, and so the interesting is during the beginning of the month, I'll still sleep more. But as I continue fasting, I see that I have more energy, or like my sleep becomes less, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes, yes, the concentration does become better. In what sense? In the sense that when you're not focused on, for example, eating or food or anything else, you're able to like sort of...
You have one single direction.
Yeah, yeah. You're able to like really focus.
There are
focus
no
on
other temptations.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, our teacher was telling us just today that one of the benefits... So you know how many times you start feeling really like lazy or sleepy like towards the afternoon?
Yeah.
But if you sort of persevere through that, you sort of suddenly see like your energy's back.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually a physiological reason for that, right? At the beginning, your stomach, you know, is sending messages to your brain. It's saying, hey, you know, this person needs like food, like
yeah.
send food, like it needs glucose, you know, it needs all those things to sort of function. But when you sort of don't do that, then the next step is that your body turns to the fat that's stored within you. Right? And it starts breaking down that fat and it turns that into glucose, and that sends the messages to your brain that, you know, this person has glucose in them. And that makes you feel less hungry or less tired.
I was actually watching a documentary which was fully about this topic that you already mentioned. Hmm. They were saying that fasting is a good way of protecting your body from getting into cancers. Because your body is going to break all those unneeded cells that are gathering together. Hmm. So then your body is going to be protected from cancer. So
if you don't have a good diet, then it's going to ruin
all
your exercise.
All the workouts are going to go into nowhere.
So similar with fasting, you know, nobody's saying that you're guaranteed to have like health benefits.
Yeah.
It's only if you sort of meet other conditions as well.
If only you concentrate on what you want.
Right. And speaking of concentration, I can't even pronounce words that well right now.
It's okay.
Yeah. So
you're fasting.
I don't know. If this is gonna, they will allow it to air this, but this is the first day of Ramadan, by the way, that we're doing this. So if I sound a little bit off,
so all the errors are just exonerated.
One thing I want to add though is that, you know, all of these things that we're saying are non-spiritual, they do sort of, they all lead up to spirituality ultimately, right?
Yeah.
If your health is good, if you're concentrating, if you have a good social life, you have a good family life, these are all sort of, these are acts of worship, right, from an Islamic point of view, you know, and they do add to your spirituality. Mm-hmm. For me, it's very difficult to divorce things from spirituality, you know, or to separate things, because I kind of like to see things in
They're
that
all
lens.
Interconnected.
Yeah, it's all interconnected. Like, it's part of who you are.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to disconnect yourself from who you are, right?
So whether it is spiritual or non-spiritual, I wish everybody to have a fruitful and blissful month in which they could just help themselves grow more and more and redefine themselves in a better way. So thank you, brother, and thank you, dear listeners.
Yep.
This was all the time
we had for today. Thank you for listening.
So until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif,
Ya Allah, 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 Allah.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. After Michael Gove, the UK's Secretary of State for Levelling Up, announced the government's redefinition of extremism, we'll be examining the implications of his statement in this week's show. It seems Mr. Gove is attempting to invoke the divide-and-rule tactics of the former British Empire to weaken the pro-Palestine movement that's been sweeping the country since October the 7th, as Latifa Abu Chakra will explain in this report.
The British government has been grappling with the question of extremism for years now. It has failed even to define extremism in any clear fashion and has been struggling to fight back against an avalanche of criticism that its counter-extremism policies are Islamophobic. The genocide in Gaza has focused minds in the British elite because of the massive sympathy for the Palestinians visible on the streets. The desperate attempt to cast pro-Palestine protesters as genocidal is a desperate attempt to split the movement. The government is trying to reframe extremism in such a way that more radical supporters of Palestinian liberation are demonized, criminalized, and disavowed by the rest of the movement.